No, it was bad when he admitted that it was really essential to have something that was good copy back in Canada. But he probably never realized the effect that would have on the families or the sailors on board ship.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we had to ban, I guess is the word to use, prevent him from going aboard. I never asked him. They would have been, they were really, the whole ship's company was really mad at him because they knew it was just not true. So anyways, so but all that aside, I think being open with the media was the way to go. And we certainly didn't miss any opportunity to do that. We had daily, almost daily briefings during the actual conflict stage with reporters. The problem we had in terms of media was that in Bahrain, where I had my headquarters and things were run over there, that was not Riyadh. Riyadh was where Schwarzkopf and Chuck Horner, General Horner, was over there, and Sir Peter. And so the British and American media were all coming out of there and not out of Bahrain.
Were you afraid of being tied with the Americans? Because sometimes the Americans can be very quiet and discreet about events.
No, if we had, if for example, I had the headquarters in Riyadh, which we could have, then we probably would have had our own briefings out of there and using the same sort of systems. But getting satellite time and all this sort of thing out of Bahrain was a different story. So that, CBC and CTV and Global and that, they couldn't have the access, if you want to call that. But any reporter, Tom Clark, was over there and spent time with him, and he filed reports, but it was a bit more difficult to do from Bahrain as opposed to Riyadh. And that's why, and of course, CNN was taking the stuff out of Riyadh, and most Canadians saw the war according to CNN, which, of course, had decided the Americans left to it.
What was your reaction to see so many countries united in one cause?
Oh, I thought it was fantastic, this was the coalition of the willing. Actually, it was that was probably the first time that really occurred. And you think about all the operations that have occurred, or most of the operations that have occurred since then, they have been involved in a coalition of the willing, and certainly in Bosnia, even though there was NATO, but there's countries opted in or opted out type of thing, East Timor, places like that. More and more the coalition, the willing, even the Iraq invasion by the Americans, it was a coalition type thing. So that was the beginning of something like that, and certainly it gave me a lot of satisfaction that our major allies that we'd worked with in NATO and elsewhere showed up there, including Australia. Australia was there, and it's gratifying when ships like Argentina came. Some of the smaller Greece, some of the smaller nations that, and the Russians that came, that also were there, and their mere presence by having their flag there was something that clearly showed that the international community as a whole wanted to rectify the problem. So good.
You weren't discouraged by the policies and regulations that the government had put on these navies.
No. I think there was nothing that could not be overcome with good coordination. But it did mean that you had to be very cognizant of what the nations could and could not do. And if you're a politician, you don't ask a guy to do something that he can't do. It's always, I'm sorry, I can't do it. And he feels bad. And you feel bad, I suppose, for asking him. But you work at it. A good example of, it happened with us too. General Horner, who was the in charge of the United States Air Force and the Allied Air Force effort over there, very much wanted the Canadian. He knew the Canadian F-18 pilots were superb. He knew the F-18 was a superb vehicle, and he wanted us to be involved and get involved in the air to ground. He wanted us to get involved in sweeping escort, which we were able to do quite quickly. But he then later on wanted the F-18s to get involved in the air to ground part of the campaign when it happened. And that was something that couldn't do at the time because there was quite a debate back in Canada over whether this was a role that the Canadian Air Force should or should not be doing. Mm-hmm. So I had to put him off for a while, and I felt bad about that, and I would keep sending messages back to folks saying, look, this is a real role, and it's one that they need our pilots they certainly want them to get engaged in, look at it. So, there, you know, at times we had restrictions too that we couldn't live up to.
But then again, with that protector, which would be supplying 62 ships a month, and that also gave you kind of, maybe we could, had to back up off the Air Force, but we'd have a supply ship that's
That's on the naval side, sure, but that was something that you do all the time. And then most of the navies don't have this shopping center that goes with them, which we do, which is the protector, where you've got everything in one vessel. And so they were able to provide, the food and fuel and ammunition to the ships that are there. And it's you keep track of what you've given away, and then at the end of the year you balance the accounts with the nation to nation, but you're not too concerned about it at that particular time. If the U.S. needs X crates of ice cream, you give them the ice cream, and then you turn around, and at the end of the year on the ice cream account you work it out between nations. Protector was, because she had that tremendous capability that no one else really did, I'm sure Doug McLean told you she was called the Chuck Wagon.
Yeah.
And the Chuck Wagon was guaranteed, was known by all the ships operating in the central and northern Gulf. They used to love to have the Chuck Wagon come alongside, or they come alongside the Chuck Wagon, and do the refueling. It meant that they could stay on station, essentially. The Chuck Wagon came to them, as opposed to them having to go all the way down to the southern Gulf, those great big tankers and everything else down there off of Dubai, to, in fact, get their resupply, and then have to come all the way back up again. So the Chuck Wagon was able to keep them on station and doing their particular job. I would mention, too, that just the Chuck Wagon, and following that, the Oasis, which was the second crew of Protector when they came over, they conducted operations themselves during that boarding phase. Protector did its share when she was out there. She manned the station, and she would do the boardings with her helicopter, and that helicopters would be working the area and communicating with ships coming through and all sorts of stuff. So she did she was more than just a tanker. She was a warship in almost all respects. She had an AAW capability. In my mind, she was the backup command ship when Athabasca was not there on the Gulf.
What sort of activity did the Navy look for when crossing Yemen forces or Iranian forces?
Those were two tense evenings. When we entered the Red Sea, the bottom end of the Suez Canal, that was when we entered, quote-unquote, the theater of war. And we were very conscious of the threats. You're in a very narrow, confined water. And at the bottom end of that southern end, you have to go by Yemen, and the islands off there are manned by military. A recent earthquake, that volcano took place there, and our ship was over there rescuing some of the Yemeni military personnel that had to take the boats because the island was overcome by a volcano. Well, there are military installations there, and they had missiles, so we were well aware of what they had. And as we made that passage at night, at speed, we were very conscious that there was a potential for a conflict there, and we were closed up and ready for anything that might have occurred. When we went through the Straits of Hormuz, that was the other one. There was a silkworm missile over there in Iran, and we knew where they were. We knew their capability. All sorts of islands. They were very confined water again. Islands contested between Iran and the UAE had been going on for decades, if not longer. And so the potential for a small patrol boat to go whipping around one of those islands was a very real threat. Silkworm targeting, from ashore, and they let us know that we were going through. There was some radiation of the weapon system. So again, as you go through there, it's a very, very tense time. And at that time, because we didn't know what Iran's political position was going to be, one had to be ready for the worst, and so we were fully prepared. We went through again at night, at speed, through the Straits of Hormuz.
When you were told to head back to Ottawa, what was your reaction? This was during what you were told to head back with.
At that time? Year.
Yeah. At the time, what did you feel? And maybe even now you can.
Well, that was both the time frame that. Interesting, back in Canada, there was. The Navy, the ships themselves knew they could take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Pure and simple. But politics back in Canada, I think, indicated that, gee, those ships over there, they need F-18s over top of them to protect them. So consequently, that's how the F-18s end up going over there. But that then raised the whole question of you've got two services now operating over there, and so how are you going to organize that? And this is where I was called back to Ottawa because the decision, I think, had been made, that we were going to have a joint headquarters where command would be exercised in a different way than we had previously done it. And this gets into another whole area, I don't know if that's what you want to get into now, but essentially, when I took the ships over, I had command of the ships, and I would report back to the Maritime Commander in Halifax, Admiral George, who would then report up to Ottawa to the Chief Defense Staff, and that would be the liaison. So when you had the F-18s coming over, you would have had, in actual fact, the F-18 group, wherever they were in the Gulf, who would be reporting back through the Canadian Air Group Commander in Europe, who would then report back to the Air Commander in Winnipeg, who would then report back to the Chief of Defense Staff. And that's not even getting into the question of the Army units that eventually came, but those will suffice to give the example. General Shasslin, who was responsible and having to answer the questions to the Prime Minister and everybody else with all this, said, I don't want to deal with all these chains. I want to have someone I can talk to right away that can tell me how to do that. So he designated me in a letter, which I have, which made me the commander of the Canadian forces in the Middle East, so that when he wanted an operational answer, he would just come to my headquarters and I would then report right back and then we would do that. So I had operational command is what came down, operational command of not only the naval ships, but the F-18s that were down in Doha, and the Air Force personnel, and eventually with the field hospital and the security group that came along with it as well, and the headquarters group. So operational command came to me, so if he needed something, he came that way. Now, how did command, how Admiral George and Admiral and General Sutherland and General Banks General Foster played into this was they were force suppliers, and so I was the supported ED commander, and they were the supporting commanders. They were supporting ING commanders who provided the people and the equipment, trained people and equipment to be deployed to me, and then once I had it, it was mine. Okay, that way there was no sort of weird change of command that would go back to Canada, and this was how you would work in an operational, and this is what we do today in terms of operational command. Part of that was can be very confusing, but I was given operational command of those forces within restrictions by letter from the Chief of Defense Staff, or by direction from the Chief of Defense Staff. I could never delegate operational command. I could delegate operational control and tactical control of those units that I had under my command to other people. But in terms of responsibility for national restrictions and national employment, I was the operational command. And that was, the Chief of Defense Staff has full command. He could delegate a portion of that to me as an operational commander. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Okay. It just made ease of operations, and I think, in actual fact, particularly the Air Force was quite comfortable with that. I personally believe, as was General Foster later on, when this thing actually got going. It made a lot of sense. This is the basis of what we do now for joint operations.
And again, it goes back to good organization.
Yeah.
That's very, which it seems very key.
Yeah.
This was the first time this has happened, though, in the military.
I should mention, okay, now we're going back to when I was, when I went back to Ottawa. And so I got back to Ottawa, and they said that we're going to have a joint headquarters. And my initial reaction was, good, let's put it on board Protector, mm-hmm. because the United States Navy had their Commander Middle East forces on board ship named LaSalle and Blue Ridge. And they were large ships with all sorts of communications capability and lots of accommodation for command and could move away so they weren't static, so they could stay out or come in close as required. All sorts of advantages. And so that was what I had in the back of my mind. And I was very quickly going, no, we want a headquarters ashore. And so that's how we ended up establishing the headquarters in Bahrain. And adopting, again, at that meeting, I was introduced, I guess you want to call it that, to the J-Staff concept in terms of how it was going to be organized, J-1 through J-3, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, et cetera, et cetera. And we basically set up the rudimentary method of creating a joint staff at that meeting in Ottawa, and then I went back to the Middle East.
How did you model this J-Staff?
It was on basically, I guess, ongoing or developed or developing doctrine that within primary United States, but also a bit of the UK, where a joint staff approach, which would have people at different rank levels, if necessary, between the J-1 personnel, J-2 intelligence, J-3 operatives, and J-4 support, J-5 plans, J-6 communications, and J-7 training is definitely here. And it just means it's a way of compartmentalizing a staff, if you want to advise the commander. And it also, didn't necessarily have to be Army Navy. It could be whatever service is appropriate. Mm-hmm. J-1 was Army, J-2 was Navy, J-3 was Navy Air Force, J-4 was Army, J-5 was Air Force, J-6 was Army, J-7 was whatever. Mm-hmm. And at different rank levels, too.
What was it like to be the only naval officer in the whole military that had this much power, this much command over the three sectors, the Air Force, the Navy, and the Army, since a lot of it, you would not know much about the Army's way of doing things or the Air Force?
Well, I guess... A, it's not something you think about power. You know, it's not the way you'd look at it. But in actual fact, one of the values of the joint system, the joint setup, is that you have the expertise and officers from all the service disciplines working together in a joint cooperative sense. And I think any of the services could be the commander. Although I was the commander the first time around and commanded the ships and commanded the aircraft and the field hospital and all that, the second time around it would have been an Air Force officer who would be the commander. And, of course, the staff would rotate around, too, would change with time as you did rotations. And the key is to make sure you have the expertise there, so no matter what commander is there, whatever his background might be, that he is getting the best advice. The person that's the commander is basically someone who makes the decision maker, can weigh the pros and cons and know what's required and make those type of decisions based on good information. So, I think I mentioned to you, there was some concern that when I was going to be replaced by an Air Force officer in the Navy circles back in Halifax, when they said, well, it's fine as long as you're there, Ken, you don't understand what we'll have done, but what's going to happen when there's an Air Force officer there? And the reply was quite simply, well, you do like the Air Force has done. You put the best officer you've got there to advise the commander so that he doesn't do something stupid on the naval side. And that's, I was blessed with extremely strong, competent, experienced officers of both the Navy, Army, and the Air Force. And when you did things, it wasn't a question of just off the top of your head. They're done very methodically and with a full recognition of the background issues at stake by whatever the force is. So it's a cooperative type, and that's the value of a joint staff. You can look at these things jointly together.
When the decision was made for the Protector to be, the crew to be taken back to Halifax and replaced by Oasis, the whole crew from Oasis, what was your reaction to this?
Well, I had written a letter back, actually, sometime in October, to the Chief of Defense Staff, indicating that I felt that this was going to go on and the potential for conflict was quite high. And duration was unknown, so therefore it was prudent to prepare more Air Force aircraft to come over, more ships to come over, and look at the whole question of sustaining the operation for some period of time. And I got an answer back, which was fine, and indeed that type of preparing for a turnover did occur. On the naval side, because it is was quite costly to put these new systems on the older ships, the decision was made to keep the same ship, only rotate the crew. Now this is a very emotional issue mm-hmm. in the Navy. Your ship is your ship, and going on someone else's ship is not something that you relish doing. It's not your ship, and the captaily approach, which you probably don't understand, but it's personal. You are an Iroquois. You're at the basket. You are whatever. To all of a sudden, if you're a preserver. And you walk over and you start taking Protector, it doesn't feel quite right. And the guys that are on Protector, to give their ship to somebody else, which they have worked up the equipment and developed and made it what it is, because it's more than just steel, it's very difficult. So I must admit, I was opposed to that approach. And I went so far in my professional opinions to raise the point. I know initially I did to the Navy, which is was correct. And when they came back and said no, we're going to change crews, I had an option and I had the capability, because I also was reporting to the Chief of Defense Staff at that stage of the game to make my feelings known or my thoughts known on this particular issue, which I did. Having said that, it was not accepted, and it was acknowledged but not accepted, and so the crew change took place. The complicating part of that one was that this was getting into the December time frame, and as I had predicted, something was going to happen. And so we had the problem of bringing over a whole new crew, and because they had not been in the Gulf, they had to go through a workup phase or that whole training phase that we had coming across from the from across the Atlantic here. They had to do that, and so there was a couple weeks involved in that. And also, because of the conflict was there, there was a question of a missile upgrade modification to the Sparrow missiles for protection. And so those things were all happening literally just before, in the period just before war broke out in January. It was a near thing to Protector would have been, Oasis would have been caught still trying to get themselves prepared when conflict actually broke out. But it turned out it was just a matter of days, 48 hours or something like that. We had the second crew on Protector ready to go, and she came up and joined in. And in all honesty, they provided yeoman service. They jumped in there very quickly and were as competent as Protector 1 under Doug McLean was. I think the people I feel most sorry for was people like Doug McLean and the initial crew that were now sitting back in Halifax when all this was going on. They had been through the tension building period and getting ready for potential for war, and all of a sudden it was happening, and they weren't there, and someone else was on their ship. You know, it was some of the wives afterwards talking, and their husbands were inconsolable, essentially. They just couldn't believe their bad fortune of having been replaced.
When the operation...
But it worked. But it worked. I would never, still to this day, I would never ever recommend that And it was something that was driven by dollars, yeah. which is not the right thing, as opposed to common sense.
You don't think it was driven also by just the crew getting tired and having to replace that? No.
No, in fact, when something like that, it's interesting. The availability of equipment and the operating ratios of those particular ships that were over there throughout was the highest it's ever been in the Navy in terms of the availability of the aircraft or the capability to keep things going, equipment. No, there's in those type of circumstances, there's adrenaline going, there's a focus going, that could have been sustained, and obviously was sustained for quite some time. So, that would not have been a problem. We adequately permit some time. They weren't always out there on the water in the middle of the Gulf. Mm-hmm. There was times when they could get back in ashore and take a bit of a breather, then go back out. But we maintain one of the highest on station ratios of any of the ships, navies that were out there. So,
did you see that once the operation went into an offense operation, did you see that the crew had to back down a bit and just stay at the same level they were, and you couldn't see them becoming more main role, more dominant player, because the crew that was on Protector had gone back and now you have a new crew? So did you see that at a chance?
No. In fact, again, as I mentioned, the second crew of Protector were just as strong as the first one, and I guess that's again a testimony to the professionalism of the sailors. But no, they jump right in, and their taskings changed in the actual conflict stage, but they were still doing the resupply, and they were as operationally ready and conducting operations as before.
When,
if I understood the question correctly,
When. Going back to this is going back to Bahrain and choosing your where you're going to put the headquarters.
Yeah.
What options? Why did you pick Bahrain, as a?
Well, that's again a very good question because when we went over there, there actually was a group that were looking at various possibilities, there was the possibility of doing something down in Oman. Fujairah was one of the places. Dubai, Abu Dhabi, those were places that were entirely possible, and Al Manama in Bahrain was another possibility. If you were operating outside the Gulf, then Fujairah and Oman would have been a logical place. If you were operating inside the Gulf, then Dubai and Abu Dhabi would have been appropriate too. The disadvantages they had: Oman was outside the Gulf, and so therefore time transit in and out through the Straits of Hormuz would have been have to something that it had to go through all the time. Abu Dhabi and Dubai are big ports, but the British, the French, and a number of the other allies were already set up there. So, room at the inn, if you want to call it that, although it's their large ports, was somewhat in question. If we were going to operate as in the Central Gulf, which is the conclusion that I had come to, that appreciation, then the logical place would have been El Manama for a couple of reasons. One, it was close to the sectors that you'd have to operate in, so the off-transit time would have been very short. Secondly, the U.S. Navy had rather strong build-up facilities in the port there that they, talking to Admiral Fogarty and Admiral Maas and Arthur, said yes, they'd be only too happy to share with us, because they wanted us in the Central Gulf too. So the support was there. There was an airhead there in the El Manama International Airport, which had a military section. I talked to the government officials, the Minister of Defense, and other officials in the government of Bahrain, and during that conference in the margins, and they were very receptive to Canada operating out of El Manama. So all those things together dictated that if we were going to operate in the Gulf, which was approved, then the best place from a all aspects, not only support but also operations, because we'd be working most closely with the United States Navy, because they were the only ones that were up in the Central Northern Gulf. No one else was up there, just them, and they were really hurting in terms of numbers.
So if we come up, they want us to come up there to help them because, A, we operate with them all the time. We common procedures. We're used to working with one another. We know the commanders back and forth as individuals. And so it was a logical fit. And because of the interoperability of all of our equipments, if something really happened, if there was a missile coming down the Gulf, we would know about it if we were alongside the that American group because of their compatibility of equipments. It would have been we would have known if we had been close to the Brits too, but not as rapidly as we would have known if we were operating with the Americans. So support-wise and operational-wise, it made sense to establish a headquarters in Bahrain as opposed to Dubai, Abu Dhabi, support base. Mm-hmm.
When was your duty over, the tour?
I guess when I came back to Ottawa, I stayed, I guess because I'd been involved with it right from square one in getting the ships ready to go, I really wanted to be there to shut it down when we shut down the headquarters and came back. So I was one of the last ones to leave, and that was, I can't recall the date now, but it was the end of March or April, if I recall, someplace in that particular time frame, in 91. I took the flag down. We took the flag down from the headquarters, and there was a few people left after me to tidy up the loose ends, but essentially the last group going out was on that group, that aircraft.
Finally, is there anything you'd like to add or mention about the Persian Gulf War?
Well, I could talk about all sorts of things. I if you sit back and look at it, I think the involvement of the Canadian military, not just the Navy, but the Canadian military in the Gulf War was the beginning of joint operations and joint perspective in Canada, which has now taken on, has led to a complete reorganization in an operational sense for Canada's military into Canada COM, into the expeditionary CEFCOM, this type of thing here. Those are all joint organizations now. So this was the beginning of all that then. It also was the beginning of, I suppose, our involvement in, beyond a single service, into the world stations when a trouble spot occurred. I'm not thinking of Bosnia was an army type thing, essentially, and the Air Force was involved in some of the aspects there. But I think in a joint fashion, it has set the stage for things like East Timor, the Canadian involvement in the war on terror in the Gulf area and around there, and Afghanistan as well. I mean, it was the first of these, the series. So the lessons that we learned, I think, through, I suppose, common sense and doing it without the... without having rules and regulations, that was a positive as opposed to a negative, I think. We were able to do things that we thought were right and based on common sense, and this is now essentially evolved without any major changes into the way we do business today. So it was kind of a satisfying that way. Although we've talked only about the Navy, and I know that's what your area that you're of expertise, you could certainly go on and talk about the professionalism of all services that were there. And if I might do that at the end, when I look at the naval operations, here was an ASW group of ships that extremely quickly were made into general service platforms. With all the training we did, we were over there able to modify that training. We're in a very heavy AAW environment. Conducted those boarding operations, which were the ones which gave Canada the highest visibility and the most important role that they possibly could play over there, and distinguished themselves by the time the conflict started. With less than 5% of the ships that were involved in the operation over there, they conducted in excess of almost 30% of the boardings that were done in the Red Sea and in the Gulf, which was just staggering when you consider that compared to the other navies that were over. So they really took that job on and the responsibilities seriously. as the conflict started, the Navy evolved or moved with it. Again, the intent had been by the commanders, at sea commanders, to divide the ships up, the escorts, and that included Terra Nova, Athabascan, and Protector, for that matter, and put them at different battle groups. And I argued with, I talked with Admiral Dan Marsh, who was the Battle Force commander, and said that we had the best staff on the Gulf. We've been doing all this coordination. We knew all what all the navies did, and to send the staff back and just have the ships go off by themselves would have been a waste of talent. And he was the one that said, well, I got a real problem. I don't know how I'm going to be able to keep all those ships, the carrier battle group, all that, supplied logistically. And do you think you could take that on? And I said, absolutely, we'll take it. And that's when I designated Captain Miller and the staff that we had brought over, my staff, that you are now going to be doing this this important role. And it led to Canada's Navy having the only non-U.S. role in the actual Gulf War. And again, I mean, I've got a letter that Admiral Kelso, head of the Navy, U.S. Navy, wrote back saying that the professionalism of the Canadian Navy ships and sailors was paramount and not necessarily appreciated here in Canada, but certainly well known amongst their allies. That was the Navy side. The Air Force, the F-18s coming in, they were, we ended up with getting the numbers up to actually 26, although maybe the books would only say 24, but there was really 26 there. And we had a air-to-air refueling aircraft, and we had the helicopters on the ships, of course, and a liaison aircraft, which was isn't that terrible? I can't remember any of it, but the small jet we have. I'll think of it as we go along. But in any event, bottom line with the Air Force, they conducted the surveillance. They learned how to operate with the naval ships over the Gulf, because that's what they initially wanted to do. They had always worked with Air Force controllers on the ground before doing that. They learned to operate with Aegis cruisers and operating over the Gulf, providing that cap station. We ended up with a northern cap station, the one closest to Iraq. We took that over. It was a Canadian station. It became the Canadian station. And when they named them all, they named it Brown, after Canada's World War I ace, Brown. So, you know, they did extremely well. But the role changed once the conflict started to go, and this necessity to sweep an escort. They learned that role. They did that role. Immediately, just transitioned out to that, turned over cap station to the Marines, I think it was, and then did the sweep and escort, escorting the American aircraft and Allied aircraft going in, to the point where we started getting requests, can we have the Canadian aircraft take us in over Kuwait and Iraq? And then, as I mentioned earlier, then came the bombing of the land-to-ground campaign, and they had to re-roll to do that. They hadn't been doing air-to-ground training, but it was very quickly they were able to do that and get themselves up to speed again and conducted the air-to-ground campaign at the critical moment. They were involved in doing things like that. Mm-hmm. So from the Air Force, and Chuck Corner, the American general, was to put his hand on the vest. Said, you were the only guys over there with the same aircraft and the same pilots that did all the missions. Mm-hmm. And no other nation had pilots or aircraft that could do that. And that was a testimony to, again, the quality of the equipment we had in the F-18 and the professionalism of the pilots we had. On the land side, we had the mobile hospital. There's very few mobile hospitals. And then when they thought about that conflict where they were going to have to go into Kuwait, have the mobile facility, the capability in the hospital, because of the heavy casualties that were anticipated, mm-hmm. and there really was. And there was a tremendous medevac type system set up with the hospital ships Mercy and Comfort and all this sort of stuff. That was a whole story in itself. But we had one of the few mobile hospitals, and just before the attack took place, they were moved from where they were in Duran, near Duran, out to a place called Al Kazuma, which is along the Kuwait Saudi border, and they were setting up their hospital initially when they got Scuds came in that night as they were setting it up, and they were all set to go in there with them, it happened so quickly, it went over so fast, they didn't have to move, and so they were basically stayed stationary, and they treated Iraqi and allied casualties during a particular time. And it was, again, a very, very professional effort. The final element, I guess, in terms of people, I would mention is the clearing of the mines in Kuwait. We had a large group of engineers that were over there, the airport, or army engineers, and the whole area they cleared around the airport, which was critical to opening up Kuwait, was something. The bunkers that were all around the airport were mined, booby-trapped, and everything else, and our guys went in and without losing anybody. And other nations lost people, but they were extremely conscientious, fastidious, and they were able to do a lot of work in opening up the Kuwait so that the Kuwaitis could return. Actually, there's two other groups that were mentioned. The establishment of the maintenance for the aircraft and also for the ships over there with the logistics detachments was also a major success in terms of being able to do that. And the train that was put in place to bring supplies and spare parts and stuff that was over from Canada, from Trenton through Europe and then down into Manama and Doha was really quite something. And again, it was a question of it was a can-do attitude, and we'll keep those things going that prevailed there. The final one, I guess I would say, was that there was tremendous support from back home, and this is from Canadians. When you're over there in the middle of all this sort of stuff and you're getting cards from kids and you're getting letters from back home and things being sent over that you perhaps didn't really need, it would all basically let you know that the nation was really behind you in this kind of thing. And that type of support allowed you to keep going, allowed you to keep doing the things that you had to do for days, weeks, months on end. And so It was a tremendous, successful story in all respects, I think. And unfortunately, it's one that, for all sorts of good reasons, I think Canadians don't know enough about.
Mm-hmm.
They know more about what Americans did and perhaps the Brits than they know what Canadians did. But it was a tremendous effort by a whole bunch of good Canadian boys and girls, men and ladies, that really were professionally competent. And I think it gave the Canadian military a real boost doing something like that. I suppose one of the regrets I have, there's one regret I do have, a couple of regrets, but one regret I would say that this was a UN-sponsored coalition that took place to get things going. And I guess the one regret I do have is that I felt that the success enjoyed by the coalition and the UN in the Gulf War would lead to a resurgence of the United Nations into a more robust organization and a better able to cope with the conflicts in the world. And unfortunately, I've been disappointed in their ability to play a more important role, I guess you want to call it that, in world affairs, since they had the means of doing that, but it didn't transcend into something that could be sustained.
Well, thank you very much for your
input. Entirely welcome. Yeah.